Welcome to the Internet of Things podcast. This is your host, Stacey Higginbotham, and your co-host,
Kevin Toefel.
And today we have a scary show for you. We are going to kick it off with the DEF CON hacks. We're going to talk about Google's behavior around location. We've got the first Easy Mesh router. We'll refresh your memory on what that is and why it matters. And Samsung has partnered with Plume to do something pretty cool. Also, Samsung has a new smart speaker. We're going to see what you guys think. Plus, Microsoft's Cortana and Amazon's Echo are talking to each other, and we're not sure what to think about that. Kevin's going to finish up his Lenovo smart display review after living with it, and I, for the first time, tried sous vide cooking. I'll tell you a little bit about that. Plus, we have a message this week from Netgear, our sponsor, and our guest this week is Allison Clift Jennings of Filament, who is going to talk about what blockchain does for the Internet of Things. It is not your typical blockchain discussion. Do not fret. You're gonna enjoy it. And now for a message from one of our sponsors, Affero. Looking for an IoT platform? Find out why Kenmore and D-Link picked Affero. Affero customers have experienced as much as an 80% reduction in time to market, 99% fewer support calls, and 10x higher activation rates. Plus, they can reuse 90% of their work from one project to the next. To learn more, visit afero.io. That's A-F-E-R-O.io. Okay, Kevin, let's get ready for DEF CON. Is your Wi-Fi turned off?
Yeah, I always get scared when we talk about DEF CON because it's crazy what the hackers do there just to prove that things are not as secure as we might think.
Just to make us feel a little more uncertain as we sleep at night. Actually, because of hotel policies, the big story out of DEF CON is not the hacks. It is the management at hotels sending security guards in randomly to check people's rooms, which is not a great thing for everyone. So we're not going to talk about that. We're going to talk about the devices that are hacked, including our favorite, the Amazon Echo. But researchers from Tencent, they spent months trying to figure out how to convert the Amazon Echo smart speaker into a surveillance device. What they did was they used multiple bugs in the second generation Echo that allows a hacker to remotely stream audio from the device's microphone. But those researchers did notify Amazon of their methods, and Amazon has fixed this hack.
That's what I like, ethical hackers.
Ethical hackers. This hack, should you be worried that someone else is going to come do this to you? It also requires access to your Wi-Fi network. And so most of us are not, we don't have people coming around trying to attack our Wi-Fi networks to get to our Echo devices. If you are that person, you know that, and you probably don't have an Echo.
Yeah, it actually, though, raises a good point. I mean, the quote-unquote front door to the smart home is, you know, your Wi-Fi network, in a sense. So you really want to focus on keeping that secure, routers updated, et cetera. We're going to talk more about routers later today, but I think it's worth the mention to point that out.
Yes. Don't give out your Wi-Fi password. I know we used to all casually be like, oh, yeah, you can have my Wi-Fi password. Guest network, baby.
I know it's not IoT specific related, but I tell you what, the voting machine hacking by the kids there really scares me.
Yeah, it does. One, well, voting machines aren't supposed to be connected to the internet. These aren't. But instead, what did this 11-year-old kid do?
Yeah, there was a bunch of enterprising young children, including the 11-year-old, who was able to hack into a mock-up of the Florida Secretary of State website and change the voting results. And guess what? It took him all of 10 minutes to do so. That's concerning. And even though voting machines aren't supposed to be networked and connected, etc., there are processing bits inside them, and they have firmware, and some of the kids got these voting machines to change vote tallies. They uploaded their own software to the machines and even had a looping GIF file on the screens of one of the voting machines. So they're just old.
They're just old.
Not the kids, the machines.
Yeah. So I don't know what to do about that. Let's keep a paper record, you guys. Another thing that was hacked, police body cameras. These people devised a way to live stream footage from the cameras. So you could basically hack into a police person who's maybe monitoring your criminal organization and be like, oh, look, they're outside. Everybody, play it cool. He also could put malware on the cameras. And then you could bring that into the police department and go to their other databases and allow you access to their network, which, as we all know, is the beginning of the end. Okay, voicemail? This one cracked me up because it was like hacking into voicemail, but I'm like, who uses voicemail?
Yeah, I mean, it's probably very hackable because people don't care about it as much, although they probably should.
Yeah, I'm like, what are they going to do? Be part of my endless parade of your prescription at the pharmacy is now ready. We are confirming your appointment at the dentist office. There was another kind of freaky, is it freaky hack? I don't know. It was a hack. McAfee hackers basically showed off the ability to hack into a hospital's network and falsify a patient's vital signs.
Yeesh.
And this gets into some of the medical device hacking. We've talked about that a lot on this show. There's a networking protocol used by medical devices known as RW HAT or R what? I'm not sure how to say it.
RWHAT. Yeah, I have no idea.
R what?
Exactly.
So basically what they did is they hacked into this protocol and let other devices come onto the network that looked like they were monitoring patients to mimic their vital signs. This is, again, an example of a case where if you are in a position where someone's really after you and wants to hack you, this is that kind of scary hack. Most of us are not in that position. I don't know if many people are going to want to freak out hospitals by creating imaginary patients or overloading people's actual vital signs with new ones. But from a like government, let's say you're an ex-Russian spy, perhaps, and these sorts of hacks kind of worry me from that perspective, because this is an interesting way to murder or kill someone or assassinate them.
Or kidnap them and make it look like they're still there and their heart is beating normally.
Oh, that just took that another level, Kevin.
So sorry.
We're going to see this in, you know, the next batch of movies and TV shows, I'm sure. But it is something that we should keep an eye on just because we're connecting all this stuff and it's providing a lot of new ways to falsify information and also allowing people access to things like insulin pumps and that sort of thing.
Too many attack vectors.
Too many attack vectors. Okay.
Speaking of attack vectors.
Speaking of attack vectors, Amazon Web Service introduced their IoT Device Defender. Actually, they didn't introduce it. They just made it available. Kevin, you want to talk about it?
Right. At AWS Invent, which I think was November of last year, they announced the IoT Device Defender for AWS, but it is now available. Basically, it is another service that they have for their IoT offerings. And what it lets you do is it lets you create audits of all of your IoT devices. You can schedule them, etc. And you can look for like a dozen different things, like certain certificates that are expiring. Perhaps there's a policy that's overly permissive. There's a whole bunch of parameters here. And the idea is so that you can kind of check, I wouldn't say real time, I would say on a scheduled regular basis, if all of the IoT devices that you are managing are doing what they're supposed to do, and or, you know, maybe they have been hacked. Maybe they are getting too much information that they don't need. So this is a way to help manage that. So it's IoT Device Defender. And again, it's all part of the AWS IoT services.
Got it. Okay, so yay. Let's get into another big story this week, which is AP, working with some Princeton researchers, discovered that Google shares your location even when you don't think so.
That's a fact. I was going to say that's kind of the story, but that is a fact. It is true. The issue here is one of transparency because Google says, hey, just disable location settings on your phone or whatever Android device or Google device, etc., and your location history will no longer have your location. That is technically true. However, there's another area of your account that tracks your location. It is the web and app activity. That's where you need to disable also the location information. You can manually delete it if you want to go into your account. You can do all that now retroactively. But I just find it very disingenuous of Google to say, to name something location history with an on-off toggle, essentially, and it's not all of your location history. That's bothersome.
Yes. And we talk about this all the time, but trust is so important with the Internet of Things and with mobile devices and with all of the data that's being collected about us. We as users have to trust that the companies are doing what they say they do. And maybe this was not nefarious on the part of Google. Maybe it was just, you know, engineers making decisions and not thinking about the UI impact or the privacy impacts for people. But we can't do that anymore. The information that is being gathered here is so personal. I really think all companies have to pay attention to this and start being way more transparent. By the way, If you want to turn this off, you have to go to, on your phone, you go to Google Settings in the Google account and tap on Data and Personalization. That's where you're going to get the web and app activity. Then you toggle the blue web and app activity slider to off. Google's going to be like, this is going to limit or disable more personalized experiences across Google services. And then, you know, you're done. And it will. Every now and then, I turn off or change my privacy and sharing settings. And I can tell you, the experience degrades tremendously.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's kind of to be expected. If they don't have that information, they can't deliver my weather without me asking or, you know, my commute.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. We have, I don't want to say traded privacy, but I guess that's probably the best word for now. We've traded some of this data for very personalized, useful services. If you don't want those services, that's fine. You can turn all that off and so on and so forth. But you kind of can't complain that you're not getting your commute times anymore and you're not getting local traffic because it doesn't know what local is for you right now. I mean, there's so many things that will disappear that we've already just become accustomed to.
Sadness. All right. Let's move from icky security and privacy topics to... dun, dun, dun. New Wi-Fi Aeris, which makes almost all of the cable modems out there. They have made the first router that works with the Easy Mesh. Dun, dun, dun. And if we remember Easy Mesh, we talked about this a while back. This is the Wi-Fi Alliance standard to allow different Wi-Fi routers to mesh with Wi-Fi routers from different brands. Because beforehand, if you wanted a mesh Wi-Fi system, you had to basically buy all Orbeez or all Eero's or all whatever. Velops. So that's still the case with those systems. But now, Aeris, and this makes sense because it's possible that if I bought my cable provider comes in, they want to be able to, you know, adopt whatever mesh systems they want in the home or maybe are already in the home.
That's true, but I kind of laughed when I saw this because this is like getting the first fax machines and then saying, well, okay, what do I do? Because even though this is the first certified Easy Mesh product, no other of the brands that you just mentioned, no other ones work with Easy Mesh. So it's still only, it still doesn't work with anything, this one. It will.
If I have a phone. Who do I call?
Yeah. So, I mean, somebody's got to be first. I get it. And it does make sense that it's Aeris who can sell these to, you know, home broadband providers by the pallet load. But the Easy Mesh part doesn't matter until somebody else says, yeah, we're going to allow Easy Mesh too.
True. All right. Also in Wi-Fi and router news, Samsung, they have what they're calling the new SmartThings Mesh Wi-Fi system. What it actually is Plume's service, rebranded. And I feel like we've talked about this in the past because I talk a lot about the future of Wi-Fi. But basically, all of your Samsung SmartThings hubs will have this technology built in. And basically, this is a rebranding of the Samsung Connect Home Mesh Wi-Fi systems to become SmartThings Wi-Fi. And Samsung had added the SmartThings capability to these Wi-Fi hubs, so it's not unusual. They also are taking the time, because they had to put the software in, I'm guessing, to add a new and improved SmartThings hub, sensors, and outlet. These are cute. The new SmartThings hub is actually cheaper. It's only going to be $70, $69.99. The sensors are between $20 and $25, and the smart outlet is roughly $35. Yay!
Yeah, no, it's good for SmartThings. I mean, for SmartThings users, or somebody wants to upgrade or wants to start their smart home, why not get a whole mesh network system with smart home capabilities? And the only downside to me is I'm not a fan of the mobile app, but that's just me.
Oh, and they added the SmartThings button. I should tell you this
because
I like
buttons. The button.
Button. Basically, it's a button. So you can have triggers on it and you can control various things around your home. So yay! Because that is the one thing. With SmartThings, I added a lot of automations, but I am almost never in the app. So if I can't talk to my Echo or, you know, it's not already automated, I don't go into the app to do anything.
Right. You know, one question that I haven't seen Samsung or Plume address, because I know they're using the Plume middle layer to integrate the Plume service on this hardware. We just talked recently about Plume subscription fees.
And oh, I don't will see they any have the subscription fees?
That's the question. Yeah, there's no mention of it. So I assume not. Since you can buy this, I would imagine it would tell you when you buy it. And I'm not seeing that.
So basically, if you wanted to, you could get the Plume capabilities without the subscription fee.
That's what I'm thinking.
Buying this Wi-Fi. And if you want, you then get this exciting smart home hub.
Right.
That also has additional radios that also work with Zigbee and Z-Wave and Bluetooth, which actually is kind of a smoking good deal.
Yeah.
And it does what Kevin wants, which is, hey, puts all the smart things, instead of a hub, you've just got Wi-Fi. So it's functional and one fewer box. Yay.
Exactly.
All righty. Moving right along, Samsung has also announced the Galaxy Home Speaker. This is the equivalent of the Amazon Echo or the Google Home. And this is Bixby's version. And it looks
like a fondue pot or a barbecue.
Strange.
It's odd. Yeah, it's just almost like a teardrop shape with the top third cut off. And it has these three silver legs. I mean, it looks like some of the modern lamps that we had in my home when modern in the 70s meant lots of chrome and curvy shapes. I don't care for the shape, but whatever. There's no price yet. It's coming soon, according to Samsung. They did use it at their Galaxy Unpacked event where they debuted the Samsung Galaxy Note 9 and the Galaxy Watch. They had 160 of these playing some of the presentation, and from my perspective, I was watching it online. I couldn't tell the difference. The sound sounded great, but I don't think I'm going to buy 160 of these for great sound. I'm also not convinced that Bixby is for me, but that's what it's going to run. Oh, by the way, it also works as a SmartThings hub.
Oh, well, that's actually kind of fun.
It is.
So it's got Zigbee and Z-Wave in there too?
It should, because it says works as a hub for SmartThings.
And we don't know pricing, so we don't can't tell pricing. You if it's a smoking good deal, but if you hate extra hubs... All right. I can see this. Samsung is going to stick SmartThings in everything. And actually, SmartThings is the basis of their apps. They're actually switching a lot of their, like, the washing machine app and the fridge app are becoming the SmartThings app.
And Bixby is the interface for it all.
Okay. Speaking of things that talk to each other, Cortana and Madam A. By the way, I get this question a lot. Madam A is just what we call Amazon's Echo Assistant because we don't want to trigger everyone's devices.
But we can say Cortana, and I'll bet it's fine.
And Bixby.
And Bixby.
Bixby, Cortana.
We probably did set off a few devices, but by far, it's mostly Google Homes and Amazon Echo, so that's why we don't say the hot words for those.
Yes, and I know some people are like, why do you call it something so complicated? I don't know. The answer is I don't know. Anyway, so back at Microsoft Build, Microsoft showed off Cortana and Madam A talking together. So basically you'd say, Cortana, ask Madam A to turn on my lights. And presumably that would happen. And you could also do it in reverse and say, Madam A, ask Cortana to find this particular email. And it was awkward. It was awkward to ask one to do the other's job and figure out who's going to do whatever job. And it was really high latency. But now it's rolling out to everyone. So everyone can see how awkward it is.
Yeah, I just think from a user experience perspective, I don't want an assistant asking another assistant to do something. The only possible benefit I see is Windows is still very entrenched in the enterprise. And while you could use an Echo there, you probably wouldn't use a Google Home because of business data. And maybe you use the integration to ask Madam A to set up a calendar event for your work people on, you know, Outlook and so on, wherever you're using Windows. Maybe there's something there, but I'm not a fan of this. And I don't understand why it took a year. They announced this last August. It took a year to basically make this skill.
Yeah, I don't know. There's a lot going on. I think there was probably also some infighting. Like back at the event, Satya Nadella, the CEO of Microsoft, was like, hey, Cortana is for business and Madam A is for home. Maybe there was some like calling an Uber. Is that a business or a home thing? I don't know.
That could be. And there could have been some debate over who gets what data, because the way this works today, as far as I understand it, when you use Madam A, Amazon gets the data. When you use Madam A to ask Cortana to do something, Microsoft gets the data. So there may have been some pushing and pulling there in that little tug of war.
Yes. So that's out. Let's see. Now it's time for the part of the show where Kevin and Stacey try things and tell you about them. Kevin last week talked a lot about the Lenovo Smart Display. He did a pretty comprehensive review. Now we've got one up on the site, which I'll link to. But Kevin, did you have, having now used it for more than 36 hours, how do you feel about it?
Well, I really like it. It is not for everybody. I'll say that right up front. If you're a HomeKit person, this doesn't do anything for you. If you are all in on Echoes, this doesn't do anything for you. It is basically a Google Home with a touchscreen, which I find very beneficial for viewing information, just like the Echo Show does. Also for fine tuning your smart home controls, because if you say set a light to 40%, it'll do that. You can say that by voice, but it then will show you a little slider on the screen and it says 45%. And maybe you're in that room and you're like, that's not enough. You just touch it. You don't need to speak again. You can just touch it and drag the slider. That is actually coming to the Google Assistant app as well. I've seen that rolling out as of last week. So you'll see what I'm talking about on your phones and tablets. If you're thinking about switching over to Google devices, this is a great, great device. And if you watch a lot of online video content, fantastic, because it comes in two sizes, 8 inches and 10 inches. I bought the 10 inch one because it has a full HD display, whereas the other one is 720p. You can voice search and give commands to say, watch cat videos on YouTube, and there it is. If you're Google Play Music, you can say, play songs by the Beatles, whatever. It does not work with as many music services, but that's typical of the Google Home platform. So that is a limitation. But I love it for watching video as well as YouTube TV, which I switched over to about 3 weeks ago. Not because of this, I switched in advance of this. And it's just nice to have a little nightstand TV to watch a half an hour of something in full HD. The sound, I think, is better than the regular Google Home. By a smidge. It's much better than the Google Home Mini. There's two 10-watt speakers in here. And I like the fact that it just looks more modern than, say, a competing product like the Echo Show. This has a nice bamboo back. It's a curved back, so you can stand the device in portrait or landscape. I will admit, I've only used it in portrait one time. That was for a Google Duo call with you, Stacy. I have not made another one, and that's the only function that works in portrait mode. This is meant to be in landscape. So I've got my photos from Google Photos on there all the time. I've got the time on there. It's 24 hours a day, get my weather and so on. I love it. I gotta be honest. There are things that don't work yet, such as Netflix on there, even though I linked my Netflix account, but it's all in the works. So I'm very, very happy. I'm using this far more than any other smart speaker in my house just because that screen adds so much more value to me.
Okay. I can't wait to get my own. And we should say this is all specific to the 10-inch one because I don't think the 8-inch one, can you switch it from portrait to landscape?
You can. And both of them have cameras to use Google Duo. But I should also mention the smartest thing they did was putting a physical shutter cover on this device. And you just slide it and the camera is off. It's blocked. There's nothing that it can see.
Okay. So $200 for the 8-inch, $250 mm-hmm. for the 10-inch.
Yes.
And Kevin likes it. I kind of want to get to it. He didn't actually talk about this, but I think he talked about it last week, but you can see things from like your Nest cameras on the device, even though there's some latency there. So exciting. Alrighty. Let's talk about my experience with sous vide. Okay. You guys know that I am a crazy person in the kitchen and I met the CEO of Chef Steps. I'm actually going to have him come on the show soon. They make a sous vide cooker. They're one of many companies that make sous vide cookers. Sous vide is cooking underwater at a set temperature, basically. So you put one of these circulators in, it's got a thermometer, it circulates water, and the idea is you stick your food in a plastic bag and you cook it at a set temperature. It takes a little longer or a lot longer, depending on the food, and it's quote-unquote perfectly done. So they're right. It is perfectly done. I will say that I would not cook something in a sous vide. I would not sous vide something. I think it's the verb. And then serve it to someone. I would want to put some char in it, so fry it up afterwards. They tell you about this in the app. So this two-stage of cooking, I'm not super keen on, just because I'm like, one pot, Stacy, da-da-da. But it really makes deliciously, they call them jammy eggs, but like eggs with the proper yolk that is not like too runny, but not too hard. And then it does a great job with meats. And for anyone who's trying to meal prep in advance, it's actually really good because what you can do is you can stick in a couple, it has to be the same kind of meat and roughly the same size, but you can flavor it different ways. So you can have like a Mediterranean flavor and a Southwestern flavor, and you can stick those in individual bags and you can basically prep different types of chicken for the week or different types of flank steak for the week, which I actually think is kind of nice.
Does the Juul have any connectivity or mobile app or any other?
It does. In fact,
okay.
It has nothing on it. There is no interface without the app, which is a questionable thing. Some people are not going to love this. I'm with them. Others like the Anova have that capability on the device. The Juul without your app is useless. So the app, though, is really good. Chef Steps has a comprehensive recipe site And some of the things, you don't even have to sous vide them. So they have lots of cooking guides that show you how to make things. But then they also like have a visual indicator. So when you're trying to cook something, like I put meat in, it's like, hey, what are you cooking? And I'm like, I'm going to cook a cow. And they're like, here's the cut. And then they show you a video, basically, a tiny, I don't know if it's a video or a GIF, but just a quick shot of how would you like it cooked? They show it to you. So you don't say medium rare. You pick the pinkness of the meat, basically. And they show someone cutting into it so you can see like the juiciness and all of this stuff. It's kind of terrible because, you know, you wouldn't sous vide when you're hungry because it can take an hour or two or three even. But you're like, oh, I want that meat now. So that is...
You know what would be neat?
What?
Well, I see something on the site that has a hands-free mode where you can kind of talk to it, and
you
I guess
you can talk to it via Madam A.
Okay, so if you can do that, wouldn't it be cool to at least see the temperature or anything else you want to see on that smart display or something similar that I was just talking about? I mean, it's got Bluetooth and Wi-Fi, just temperature information and or a timer is simply small bits of data. Hmm. I see a lot they could do with this in terms of integrations, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah, they could integrate it to work with the show. It doesn't work with Google Assistant yet, so sorry, Kevin. Oh,
that's okay.
If you're interested in this... The Joule, which is what I tried, is $179 for the cheaper version, and then they have an industrial one with a bigger clamp that is $199 on Amazon. So, and there are others, like the Anova goes on sale regularly for like $79. So, you know, pick what you will, that's just the one I used, but I was actually pleasantly surprised, and this is very much an IoT thing in the sense that it's using the processing power on your phone to make these kind of decisions about, and the sensors in the particular sous vide cooker to figure out the most appropriate way to cook your food, which, awesome! All right, Kevin, I believe it is time for our voicemail.
It is.
So this week's voicemail from the IoT Podcast Hotline is from Jesse, and it deals with fans. The IoT Podcast Hotline is brought to you by Schlage. Do not miss your chance to win a Schlage Sense smart deadbolt and Wi-Fi adapter. To do this, all you have to do is call us at 512-623-7424, and we randomly pick every month someone to win. So call us, ask us a question, do it all before the 31st of August at midnight ET, and you too could win a Schlage Sense smart deadbolt and the Wi-Fi adapter. Just remember, smarter homes start with Schlage. All right, let's hear from Jesse.
Hi, Stacy and Kevin. This is Jesse from Connecticut here. I'm currently building a house and had a question about smart control of overhead fans. I'm going to have a fan in my bedroom, and I asked my electrician to wire a separate switch for both the lights on the fan and the fan itself under the assumption that smart control of both would be easier with separate switches. I am having Lutron cassette switches installed throughout the home for lighting control. I also have a Samsung SmartThings hub for other control and have a number of Madame A and Google devices for voice control. What would be the best way to control a multi-speed fan? The specific make and model of the fan I'm getting is a Kichler Canfield. Thanks. Bye.
Jesse, this is a good question and you're in luck because I have faced this actual dilemma myself and I have all the devices you have. And the best option is the GE Z-Wave Plus Smart Fan Speed Control Device. So basically, this is on Amazon, it is a $37.82 device, $37.82. And you want to get the paddle fan control device. This is going to turn your fan on and off, and you do a long press to control the fan speeds. It works really well. It uses Z-Wave Plus, so it's going to work with SmartThings. It also will work with Wink and Madam A. And you were smart in dividing up the things, I will tell you. Mm-hmm. I will give you super props. Good on you. We actually last week talked about a device called the Bond IR and RF remote. For people who have existing fans that they want to control, that's actually a really good option if they have a remote that goes with their fan. They can use that remote to program it to the Bond, and then it would work with Madam A and an app. So just throwing that out for people who maybe were not as smart to divide their lighting and their fan control.
And Jesse and anybody else has to be careful. If you do go to buy this on Amazon, there are several switches there. And this looks exactly like the paddle light switch, but that only controls the lights. So make sure you get the paddle for fan control.
And on the box, it says easy smart fan control and shows a picture of a fan. So
yep. You know,
really look for that. And that's a really easy answer for you, Jesse, so hopefully you can call us back and let us know how it went. Okay, I think that's it for the news segment of this week's show. Stay tuned to hear from our guest, who is Allison Clift Jennings, the CEO of Filament, discussing what blockchain can do, especially around microtransactions. And it's a really good, we actually get a little philosophical in there. So if that's your bag, you're going to like this. If it's not, listen anyway, because, you know, you could never have enough blockchain in your life. And now let's go to a message from this week's sponsor.
Hey everyone, we're taking a break from this week's Internet of Things podcast for a message from our sponsor. This week's sponsor is Netgear. And I have John McHugh, who is a Senior Vice President of Commercial Networking at Netgear. All right, so we've talked a couple weeks about Netgear, which not only has a home-based router business that a lot of us are familiar with, but also a commercial and small to medium-sized business solution. So let's talk about how you guys make that easier for commercial customers to set up and operate their networks.
You know, one of the things, Stacey, that Netgear really takes pride in is making networking technology accessible to folks who have little or no networking knowledge. Kind of taking our expertise from home networking, where millions and millions of people rely on Netgear for their home networking solutions, and most of those folks aren't really technical specialists. We do the same for small business owners.
Okay, so as someone who's dealt with this, are we talking about, oh, now I've got a router and then I've got access points everywhere? And how do you make that process easier?
Let me give you a great example. Orbi Pro, right? Orbi Pro is a solution for a small, maybe 4,000 or 5,000 square foot retail outlet or bed and breakfast, even a hospitality venue like a restaurant or whatever. And what it allows you to do is stand up a small business network, turn on guest user access, be able to log who the guests are that use your ecosystem, have a bunch of ports and Wi-Fi for business-oriented stuff that you don't want the guests to get access. And it does that all in a way that somebody who's a novice at networking can turn it on and make it run.
Okay, so that's Orbi Pro. And we've been talking about your Insight line. So how is that different?
Insight kind of plays the next role up. Orbi Pro is really designed as a turnkey for a do-it-yourself networking person. I like to say Orbi Pro is for people who don't know what a VLAN is. And so you can set up a great, secure business network and not know anything about networking whatsoever. But if you want to go to the next level, then Insight bridges that gap. It's both simple to use, it's common English, straightforward, but it lets you get in and start dealing with the real complexities of more scale-out networks.
What are some of those complexities?
You know, the most common one is that people like to think about structuring their network and isolating various domains. One common thing I hear from my customers is, I want all my Internet of Things on a separate VLAN so that my home network, my base business network is completely isolated and unhackable. Well, that requires VLANs, that requires port assignments on switches, and a lot of stuff that kind of goes to the next level. Insight allows you to be able to go to full security in that ecosystem.
Where can I go to find out more about Insight and Orbi Pro?
www.netgear.com/insight.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the Internet of Things podcast. This is your host, Stacey Higginbotham, and today's guest is Allison Clift Jennings, who is CEO of Filament. Hi Allison, how are you doing today?
I'm so well, how are you?
I am excited because we have talked for like years almost about how we're going to use the blockchain in the Internet of Things. So let's orient people and tell them where Filament fits in.
Filament started in the IoT space originally, and this was 6 years ago, so it's been quite a while. A few years ago, we started to get into this realm of having an engineering problem that we can get into in a little bit. But fundamentally, the blockchain turned out to be a fantastic solution to this problem. And then from there, we started to realize that this was actually much bigger than our original issue. And now we're squarely in this marriage between the blockchain and the Internet of Things.
Awesome. We should probably talk a little bit about the hardware problem that you encountered.
I think it's important only because there's a lot of hype in this space. I mean, you take the Internet of Things, which is fairly hypey, and you add blockchain, which is also hypey. You kind of get this like meta hype. The hardware problem we originally addressed that we were confronted with was that we had a lot of customers of ours who wanted to pay for our Internet of Things product, but they wanted to pay for it per use or per month, for instance, instead of purchasing it up front, like a lot of consumers do. These are big companies who don't want to purchase up front. It's why they lease their laptop at a lot of large corporations. In the technical, in the financial world, this is called capital expense versus operational expense, or CapEx versus OpEx. This is a common term you'll hear a lot in this space. So what we ended up having this challenge was companies saying, look, we want to pay for this device of yours per use or per month, an OpEx requirement in how they want to buy it. The problem is that we didn't have a good way to enforce this recurring revenue model on the device because the devices would often be offline. And so it's a fundamental engineering problem is how do you enforce a recurring revenue model on a physical device that isn't always online? And it turns out that this is a very large problem within the distributed system space of computer science. It's been researched for half of a century. There's some famous and infamous problems, Byzantine generals problem, Sybil attacks, et cetera. These are well-known, well-understood, poorly solved. And it turns out that the blockchain happened to be a recent invention that had addressed those very issues. And so when we started looking deeper into it, we realized that we could actually solve this sales problem with some aspects of the blockchain. And that kind of started our journey down this road.
Okay, so you guys, your solution then to this was to build your own hardware?
It was, because we needed to be able to store the cryptographic keys for the blockchain securely. And the only way we knew how to do that, and still the only way we know how to do this, is via a separate secure chip. And so that's where we went down this road of, you know, originally, again, only having this IoT edge device, sensor device. We've moved now squarely into bringing about the security or the hardware aspect of making these machines blockchain native by having the hardware secure elements that we've built to manage all of the blockchain specific pieces that are required.
Okay, but that's actually not why you got into this business at all. So...
It was not.
So let's talk about
such
that.
As a startup.
Yes. So you're like, I'm going to solve this problem. Oh, yeah. Nope. Now I have to build something completely
exactly.
from scratch. So
that's right.
What were you trying to do 6 years ago? You saw this opportunity and you're like, wow, we could do X. What was so cool about both IoT and blockchain?
Right. It's a good question. So the path was originally that the plan and the what we had understood is that our hypothesis was that industrial customers. So these are like Fortune 1000 companies. These are big, big companies. These aren't our customers, but like the GEs of the world and the Ford Motor Companies of the world. Like these were the companies that we thought wanted industrial IoT solutions because of this coming IoT wave. And it's partially true. The truth is, as we found out through a lot of hard struggles in the sales process, was that there are several people in the company who do want it, but there are also several people who do not want it. And it turns out that those who do not want it can often veto the entire process. And there's only one way to learn this lesson, Stacey, is to like go through the process and then have the sales close shut down on you. And it's rough because as a startup, time is limited and then everything is based around time. And so we had started in that space, purely industrial IoT. When we solve the problem for having our little device be payable as the ongoing contract or per use, what we call basically giving it an economic capability. We then had that aha moment, in which was, wait a second, if we can do this for selling our own product to customers, what happens if we allow our customers to also sell their products or services in these new ways? In other words, what happens if the products that they make that are physical devices could also be economic in nature? And if they could be, does it allow them to have entire new business models built upon it? And more importantly, does it get those who used to veto it to now say, oh, heck yes, we definitely want this because we can build a new product upon this? And so that's led us up to where we're at today. But through a lot of hard lessons, by trying to sell industrial IoT into the space, it's very difficult, unfortunately.
Okay, so let us define these terms a little bit more. So when you say making this product economic, or this machine, giving it economic capabilities, is that simply like letting a machine have the trust and value store to make payments? How would we?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's an important point. So when Filament thinks about making machines economic in nature, what we mean is that machines by default can't, or infrastructure maybe is a better way to think of it. So think of like cars, trucks, power poles, things that allow us to be a society. Those are often not economic in nature, meaning they can't participate economically, or put it another way, they can't transact value. For some people, value is data. Other people, value is currency or money transfer. Now, what that looks like is when you start to blend those together, it looks like a cryptocurrency. You can start to see where we're going. But if those infrastructure pieces or those machines could transact value or trade or exchange, you know, even payments, can new systems be built upon it, new business models that allow us to do things differently? And so Filament simply, our technology simply allows these machines to have the core components required in order to transact with a blockchain. And by extension, pay or be paid or attest to sensor data that is created. In other words, proof that something has happened cryptographically. These are all types of value exchange and by extension, what we call economics in aggregate together.
So let's actually take a step by step because this is a pretty, I think it's not a hard concept, but examples totally help. So let's go with something
absolutely
pretty basic we're probably familiar with, like a toll road, for example. Let's envision something we know and love now with the machines having this inherent capability, and it comes from implanting your chip in them, right? In the cars and in the roadways.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. If you take vehicles today, they're usually operated by people who usually own the vehicle or pay regularly for the use of the vehicle through a lease or something, and usually also pay other entities to operate the vehicle, whether that's fuel or insurance or sometimes a ticket to a highway patrolman or a toll road. These are various aspects of payment that the transactions that a person operating the vehicle needs to make in order to use the vehicle over time. So when we start talking about how this might look differently with our technology is that as we see in the future on the horizon of autonomous vehicles starting to happen, they'll still need to transact on behalf of either their owner or operator, the rider, the manufacturer. Somebody will need to pay for the fuel, the recharge, the ticket, the fine, the toll road fee. And so these are all transactions that need to happen. And there's just not a way to do that today. This is like IoT today is literally like 1992 internet. So we had gray background websites. Sir Tim Berners-Lee invented the World Wide Web, and we were all excited about making our own web pages, writing HTML. But there was no e-commerce yet. And then came along this concept of e-commerce, which allowed the internet to be transactive. That's really all we're trying to do at Filament is the same thing, is to, could we allow machines to be transactive as well? Because what happened when we brought e-commerce to the internet? We got companies like Amazon and Alibaba and eBay and Craigslist and all of these amazing companies that simply could not have existed without the commerce aspect of the internet. And so when we can bring that to machines, we think the future Alibaba's, Amazon's, eBay's could be built upon this platform because now machines can transact.
Let's stick with payments for a moment longer. A lot of people look at this as like a way to enable microtransactions. So I feel like in some ways that's a bit limiting, but we do need a way to do microtransactions. So can you kind of give us your vision for how that might work?
Yeah. So microtransactions are funny because they are very beneficial in many ways, but the technology industry as a whole has been touting microtransactions for years, you know, almost since e-commerce came around. We were going to pay publishers tiny slivers of payment for reading their websites. We were going to pay podcasters. We were going to pay a lot of people a lot of things in microtransactions, and it never really took. And the big reason why tended to be that, you know, the minimal transaction fee to make a payment in the traditional credit card or electronic payment world that we had up until 10 years ago was still too high for microtransactions. It would be like going to the ATM and pulling out 30 cents but having to pay $2 in order to get your 30 cents worth. It just doesn't make sense, right? And no one is actually going to do that. So there is an aspect to this that we're looking at, that cryptocurrency does often allow for the possibility to have microtransaction capability without that transaction fee overhead, which we've so often had as a problem. This isn't always true, however. Those who are familiar with the cryptocurrency space will know that public blockchains such as Bitcoin, even Ethereum, are quite expensive right now to actually transact on and certainly won't pass the microtransaction test. Luckily, there are some new technologies in that space, some of them like such as Lightning Network, that can start to address some of these and start to get rid of some of these transaction fee requirements. All that is to say that this technology, along with some of the more recent cryptocurrency development, is setting up the situation very nicely to actually be able to do microtransactions at the hardware level. Finally, it only took us like 30 years to get here, though.
That's how we feel about a lot of like advancements in technology. We're like, we saw this coming, and then poof, now it's actually here and usable. So let's talk about value, because this is, along with the cryptocurrency hype, I think a lot of people don't think about the idea that attestation of data and saying, hey, this came from here, that's a really important thing. And I'll just share with our listeners. I was talking with someone from Bosch, and they were talking about connected trucks, fleets of trucks. And it would be really beneficial to have some sort of decentralized way for those trucks to identify, if they're self-driving, to identify that they can join a fleet at one point in time and take advantage of a platoon together. So let's talk about machines being able to not just exchange currency, but also data or trust.
Absolutely. It's funny because, you know, a lot of in the technology world, at least, you know, where we've spent a lot of time in, you know, as an industry, again, we've spent a lot of time on networking and data and big data and machine learning and AI and data. That's been a prime focus of the tech industry for decades. And I think that economics has gotten the short end of the stick to some degree. You know, even when people sell things, they're always after the data. Data is the new oil. I mean, we have all of these catchphrases that we seem to use. In Filament's perspective, we think of it in the following. If you look at information or what's called information theory, data is the bottom rung of this stack. It's information theory stack. It goes data, and then on top of that is information, which is data that's organized. And then on top of that, you have knowledge, which is basically information categorized into buckets. And then you have on top of that wisdom, which is then forward-looking based on previous knowledge learned. So it's almost like you can be proactive, right? This is a field of study called information theory, and it lets you kind of think about how we deal with data. There's a similar thing that we've started to dig into in the economic side, except that the bottom rung is not data. The bottom rung of economics is trust. And then on top of that, you start to have like parties or participants in a marketplace. And then on top of that, you have a market. And then on top of that, you start to have things like transactions. And then on top of that, you can do like reputation. Reputation is like wisdom, but on the economic side, like I will trust you again because I've trusted you in the past. And we've done good business together. So it's interesting because there's parallels between these two fields, and both of them are just as powerful as the other, but we spent a lot of time with data in the tech world and not so much with economics. And so Filament, you know, talking about value transfer that you mentioned earlier, requires trust to be absolutely rock solid because it's the bottom rung. If you can't trust the other party, your reputation falls apart, the market falls apart, the transaction falls apart, you just don't know. And that's often where most attacks happen today in the cryptocurrency space, is like trying to steal keys and misrepresent on the trust side. So when we think about this, we really do want to establish really strong roots of trust. And then on top of that, let others build their applications on this new platform.
Let's break down this concept of trust from an economic theory perspective, because what you're talking about is just that it's secure. It's trust that it's secure and your stuff won't be stolen, or mostly just stolen. It can't be, the value cannot be tampered with, correct? Because there's also an element of trust in reputations, like what I think of as a person, like believing in, like trusting another person, but that's more a reputational thing, correct?
Yep, I think so.
Okay. Because the tech companies, I would look at them, and I think going into IoT and even something as abstract for a lot of people as machines being able to make transactions, I feel that a lot of companies have left the reputation trust component behind. It's becoming increasingly clear that if you're going to say, if you're going to hand a company the keys to predictive maintenance or some sort of aspect of your business where they're going to become a partner with you, that that relationship and the reputation and trust there becomes so much more important. And I don't see a lot of companies thinking that way. And I think that may be a mistake.
Yeah, I completely agree and concur. In fact, we even see it in our political sphere and other areas of society where what happens when trust breaks down, it can be pretty detrimental, from being able to trust our election system to trusting political perspectives. Trust is inherent to the human condition. And I completely agree with you that to the degree that we don't infuse trust into our systems, then we're losing out on possible future capability and, quite frankly, less pain and issue later, because we have trust baked in now. We don't have it yet. We're not quite there. I do believe it starts with people reconsidering what trust means and how important it is to any system that they would develop.
Okay. Well, that got deep real fast.
Sure did.
I'm like, and it's something that I'm not sure we can solve, but if you have any tips on, tips even sounds so blasé about something that's really so important, but ways to establish real partnerships with people, what are the kind of things that a company should be both communicating and also internalizing in their own company culture?
In terms of considering this as a first-class property of their company, having trust be a first-class property of their company, I think it really comes down to prioritization. It's not unlike the traditional security officer or, you know, chief information security officer, CISO, at major corporations, where that didn't used to be an executive role. And then we had the Home Depot and Target and other hacks where companies started to realize this is a requirement. This is a necessary thing for us to take seriously, especially as more devices become connected. And so I do believe that, you know, will we have a chief trust officer? I'm not sure. It could probably fall under CISO, but regardless, it needs to have a seat at the table somewhere where somebody champions it. Someone's job is on the line if it fails. It needs to be treated as a real thing because it will be one of the most exploitable areas. And we're already, again, seeing it in some ways through traditional human or social systems, through even just traditional hacks like spear phishing, like people sending fake emails. You know, CEO told me to wire some money, so I did it. Like, that's a breach of trust. At the end of the day, people assumed that they could trust an email coming from where it says it's from, and it's not true. And then they actually follow through with the request. So I do believe that trust fundamentally needs to be much more spoken of, treated with respect, treated with as a type of, I don't want to call it a liability, but a responsibility perhaps of companies who start to connect infrastructure, start to move into this wireless world or connected world rather, that they must also have some aspect of responsibility around the trust of these devices, not just of people, you know, exploiting the devices, but using the devices in botnets to exploit others, which is also another very big risk that we all run into.
Right. So, and it could be as simple as, I shouldn't say that. It could be something as proactive as thinking about training your algorithms to handle adversarial attacks, which
exactly
is kind of crazy hard to think about, but is probably really important.
Right. But what good is your algorithm if you know that it could be, you know, trivially attacked? The question is then, can you trust that algorithm? And how do you know when it's actually acting correct? It's a great point.
Okay. Wow. We have talked about a lot of things. And Allison, I appreciate you making me think so hard this afternoon. I really enjoyed it. Thank you for coming on the show this week.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always nice to join you.
That's it for this week. Thanks so much for listening. And remember, if you'd like more IoT news, sign up for my newsletter at stacyonIoT.com. We'll see you next week.